In 2000, I was working at the Outside Music Warehouse in Toronto, packing CDs into boxes with other like-minded guys and bands and fine art types. Time spent at the warehouse got me very familiar with labels I had always wanted to sink my teeth into, like Blood and Fire, Zappa albums on Ryko Disc, and Varese. I was also able to stumble upon a disc called Sounds of Liberation by Che, a short-lived band fronted by Brant Bjork, ex-drummer of Caius and Fu Manchu. It struck me because the EP featured Alfredo Hernandez on drums, who, strangely enough, took over on drums in Caius when Brant left. The EP blew me away. I was already familiar with Brant's solo work on guitar and vocals, having the Jella Manta album he put out in 1999, and loved it. After these albums, I always collected everything he put out, whether it was Brant Bjork and the Operators, more solo albums like Keep Your Cool, Local Angel, Tres Dias, and Punk Rock Guilt, or Brant Bjork and the Bros with Saved by Magic and Somera Soul. When we put out our album Sleep is the Enemy back in 2006, we had to figure out who would open for us when we toured it. And I threw out one of my favorite bands into the mix for possible consideration, Brant Bjork and the Bros. But I thought it was a long shot. Well, lo and behold, the band was free and wanted to do it. I was floored. Not only were we going to tour with one of my favorite bands, but I was going to get to see them every night and hang out with them. Brant and I had already met 2 years earlier in Marburg, Germany, when on a day off from tour, from our tour, we went to see Brant Bjork and the Bros do a show with one Nick Oliveri, then newly departed from Queens of the Stone Age. So it wasn't exactly a blind date like a lot of tours with bands can be, but more of a reacquaintance with some like-minded dudes. Our tour with Brant Bjork remains one of my favorite tours we've ever done. Maybe this has happened to you, and maybe you can call it extrasensory perception, but for most of my life, I've noticed that there are certain people that, before even meeting them, sometimes just on a photo alone, I instinctually know I will get along with that person and become good friends with them, or at the very least, end up spending a large amount of time with them. Brant has been one of these people. He's just a good hang. I've said this before, but if there really was a rock and roll high school, then Brant Bjork would be the coolest kid in the school. He is the dude. His singing, guitar playing, and drumming are so tasteful and so on point from where I'm coming from. I always have to keep abreast as to what he's doing. By now, everybody familiar with Brant Bjork should know that these days, Caius Lives is taking up most of his time. And with a new album on the verge of release, the band has decided to change their name to Vista Chino. It doesn't matter what they call themselves. It's just a chance to hear these desert guys bang out some music together again. I caught up with Brant while we were out on the Soundwave Festival in Australia. These were the last gigs they did under the name Caius Lives, and with Mike Dean on bass, it was definitely worth catching. What started as a casual catch-up conversation in the hotel lobby eventually became what you're about to hear, our third Soundwave podcast. Like all the other podcasts recorded at Soundwave, my voice was pretty shot. Even though this was the first one I ended up recording during our stay, you can hear how gruff my voice quickly became. Maybe it was a mix of jet lag, sleep deprivation, and just plain old giving it for the Australians that had it on the brink, but at least I'm still able to speak here. I'm also using only one mic, since I wasn't able to travel with my usual battalion of Yetis. And I'd like to thank Blue Mic Microphones for their Yeti mics, and of course Skull Candy headphones, because I couldn't do this podcast without both. So here it is. Here's my good friend, Brant Bjork, on this episode of the official Danko Jones podcast, and it starts now. All right, so we're here today, first time doing a podcast in Australia, but the podcast is on the road, and who better to start
the podcast, the Road Podcast, with a man that I've toured with, Mr. Brant Bjork. Brant, how you doing, man?
I'm doing great. Doing really good.
We're here in your hotel room, and I'm upstairs. I came in the elevator, but we just hatched this. No plans. We're just hanging out outside the hotel, just catching some wind.
Yeah.
And I just said, yeah, you know, if I do this podcast, and you're like, yeah, won't do it. So here we are. How's it going with Caius Lives? I caught you guys the first day at Soundwave, and you guys smoked it.
Wow. Well, that's awesome. I appreciate that. Yeah, that would have been Brisbane. And that was a fun show. And things are going well. This is, for those who are unaware, this will be our last run here in Australia. These string of shows will conclude the Caius Lives chapter. And so, you know, as soon as we get home, we're running with the new name Vistachino and the new record. But we're very, very excited to be in Australia, and we're super excited to, finish things up and play these last shows. And so everything's super rad. We're stoked.
The one thing of note for these shows that I don't think people have seen with Caius Lives before, I've seen you guys with Scott Reeder, and Mike Dean is on bass for this run, and it's a very special treat for everybody who's getting to watch this version of Caius Lives, because Mike Dean is a monster bass player.
Mike Dean is a monster bass player and even more monster guy. He's a very cool guy. And for me, it's a dream come true. He's always been one of my favorite bass players. And, bass players, it's kind of always proved to be an interesting element to Caius. And, things just worked out where we had to quickly make some adjustments for the Australian run here, and I thought, I'm gonna shoot for the moon and give old Mr. Mike Dean a call, and within like 10 minutes, the dream was realized. So he came out to the desert, and we woodshedded and worked on the songs for about 4 days. And then here we are. And so, yeah, I'm really, really excited. I think I speak for the rest of the guys in the band, John and Bruno. And it is a treat for the fans. And I think, for me, it's just a real poetic and wonderful way to wrap up the Caius, legacy, and with playing our last shows with Mike Dean on bass. I think that's awesome.
It's awesome. I didn't know about the Mike Dean edition until we were on the flight over here on the journey over to Australia. And just knowing about you guys, I always keep tabs as to what's going on with all you guys individually and as a unit. And I was just wondering, like, who's on bass? Like, who could they have gotten on bass to, like, I mean, the bass lineage in Caius is like, you got to keep, I don't know how further you guys got to top, who is taking that slot. Mm. And then when I heard it was Mike Dean, I was like, oh, you mean the guy who should be in Metallica? That's pretty heavy. Yeah. I think for me, I know there's a whole bunch of friends back home. If I send them an email with a JPEG of me and Mike, I will get severe jealousy replies back. So I can't wait. I tried doing it yesterday. I met him for the first time.
Yeah.
And you guys were on your way out. So I just said, hey. Yeah. And then just downstairs, before I went upstairs, you were talking to him. Mm-hmm. Oh, hey. Mm-hmm. I did. You didn't see it because you had your back mm-hmm. to me. And I was like, yeah, okay. I went right back into the elevator. But I saw you guys, like I was telling you, outside the hotel, fucking juicy bass that fits so perfectly with everything that everybody knows of Caius. Mm-hmm. And, the Vistachino is just a new chapter into what you guys are already doing. Mm-hmm. And, be cool if Mike was, but whatever. But I think it's cool that he's here.
Yeah, I think I totally understand where you're going with that, and I think I share the same opinion that it would be super deluxe to move into the future. with the Mike Dean. You know, he is you know, a cornerstone in Corrosion of Conformity, and the world is a better place with them existing. And yeah, but so it's tough, man. But you know, we'll just see what happens. He's an awesome bass player and an awesome person. You know, it's amazing what he's done in a week's time with the Caius material, because let's face it, it's not the easiest material to just pick up and run with. And I mean, he's, you know, it's just amazing. It'd be super, super insane to see what we were capable of doing in like 6 months' time of playing together. I mean, there's moments in the desert when we were jamming where it was like, I mean, literally jamming, and it was getting into zones of like, wow, this is incredible. So I think there is a musical future for us, and we'll just have to wait and see exactly what that is.
I know, COC just put out a new album. Did you fly him in from, where is it, North Carolina? Or
Raleigh, North Carolina.
Yeah. So he's still out there.
Yeah, he still lives out there, and along with Reed and Woody. And they did. They just released a new EP on Scion, with Scion. And it's really cool. It's really, of course.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, they're still an active, super rad band. Yeah.
So when I saw Caius Lives the other day for the first Soundwave, that was the first time you guys were jamming in front of people?
That's the first time we ever played in front of people with Mike Dean.
You know, when I saw you guys in Toronto, I was on your bus talking to you and John in the back lounge, and that was the first show of your tour.
Yeah.
You guys were really nervous.
Yeah, that was the first show. And, yeah, and I think that was the first, was that the first show with Reed? No, I don't know if that was the first show with Reed. It might have been.
There was some, like, real tension, not, like, tension, bad tension, but you guys were really nervous about it.
I think it was. I think that had a lot to do with it.
I think
it was the first show with Reed.
There was something special about it.
So
that's cool. How we know each other is through us reaching out to you, like 7 years ago, because we're all big Brant Bjork and the Bros fans, and all your solo albums. What's going on there? Because you were, for a while there, you were like churning them out pretty steadily. Has that taken a back seat, or
you know, the when John asked me to get back together and pursue Caius again, it's just, Caius is one of those things that just demands a lot of attention, and it kind of consumes you, and rightfully so. And I took the offer and ran with it, knowing that I was going to have to put my solo work on the shelf, so to speak. And I did just that. I've actually got 3 records literally recorded and on the shelf, which I'm going to get to this year. But you know, it couldn't have come at a better time, because I did hit it hard for about 10 years with my solo work, and I felt like I could use a change, you know. Getting back on the drums and returning to Caius was just an amazing left turn that was really, really healthy for me as a musician, and as in terms of just being creative and stuff. So even though it was a return to the past, it was really foot forward in the future for me as well. So it was good. And I you know, there are moments, of course, when I get hungry to work on solo work, and I do still record some songs from time to time, like just sketches and ideas and stuff. But I'm pretty content where I'm at right now. And we'll just have to see.
And how are the other bros doing? Like, how's Dylan doing? Is he still part of the fold there? And
Dylan's doing good. In fact, he was just up at my house out in the desert a couple weeks ago. We were hanging out, just chit-chatting. He lives a couple towns away, so we hook up sometimes during the week when I'm out in the desert and just hang out and rap and listen to music. And he's doing really good. And we do talk about getting back together, you know, if and when I get my solo band, the Bros, back together. We'll see. We haven't made any formal plans, but, you know, Dylan's, he's like a brother to me, so.
Would he be a consideration in the Vistachino, or is that a separate thing, or?
You know, I don't know. It's funny. We did talk about that a little bit, and I honestly don't want to speak for Dylan, but I know Dylan is still recovering from the removal of a pretty serious tumor in his brain.
Yeah, that was like 4 years ago or something.
Yeah, and he's doing great. He's recovered, and he's doing really well with that. But you know, he is still cautious about not getting too radical, so to speak, in his lifestyle. So let's face it, a touring rock band could be maybe a positive thing for him, and maybe not. I guess it depends on him, you know. But we have talked about it, but we don't know. You know, right now we still have some work to do with Caius Lives with this last run and a couple touch-up pieces on the new record. So we're just focusing on that, and then when we come to the bridge of finding a bass player for Vistachino, we'll see. We'll see what happens.
When I saw Caius Lives, I think I've seen you guys 3 times. I even spent New Year's with you, like, last year at Cherish's place in Toronto, at Cherry Cola's Rock and Roll. And that was the only time out of the 3 where I didn't see grown men crying. Grown men crying. There was, like, the show that we saw in Toronto, which was like the first show of your tour, a friend of ours had a box of, he brought a box of Kleenex, and he was ready, he was showing everyone he has a box of Kleenex, and he's like, I don't know if I can handle this. that's how crazy and such a response you guys elicit with the music of Caius. I know there's a big pressure for you guys to follow it up with Vistachino, and everybody's looking to you guys for, you know, the next chapter. Even if it's under a different name, everybody's going to know what it really, you know, what it is and what it stands for. Is there that, you guys feel that pressure, or is it because of people like me say there's pressure that you feel the pressure? Or?
No, I think there's certainly pressure, and rightfully so. I mean, you'd have to expect a return to a band like Caius after that much time has passed, and you know, let's be brutally frank. We did have to experience and go through a very intense, you know, internal conflict, and all that adds to the whole experience of us just wanting to celebrate our band. And everybody's got their own ideas of what Caius is and what it was and what it shouldn't be or should be in the future. And you know, so we felt all of that, and but I think we just did a great job of just being who we are and being the musicians that we are, and we just, you know, we went to work, man. Caius, what Caius is to us is not necessarily what Caius is to everyone else, and that's not to, I say that respectfully. I mean, you know, it's fans are everything. But Caius is just something else for us, man. And we, you know, we went to work. We made a record.
You know, this podcast, I try to, like, not have it be, like, so Q&A. And just me being, like, a fanboy, I guess it's turning into that. So I'm just trying to figure out how to get off this whole Caius thing, because I'm sure you're going to have, or you have had enough of these kinds of interviews and shit. So I'm going to just ask other questions and start other conversations that has to do with growing up in the desert, because everything I've read about anyone associated with the desert within the whole Caius era, especially, you know, from you, people like you and from John talking about growing up in the desert. And I've heard it secondhand from Cherish as well, friends of Cherish. And it just sounded like the perfect spot to get into, like, all kinds of stuff when you're a kid. Like, how do I have it right in terms of, like, getting into punk rock, heavy metal, you know, casual light drugs, just in skateboarding. You know, that whole lifestyle to me is idealized because I live in Toronto, and you guys are out in the desert. You come out with this crazy-ass cool music, and I don't know, you guys just seem to have everything down, whereas back in Toronto, I felt like we were always playing catch-up to places like the desert. Is that true? Have I idealized it too much?
Well, I think that's just the natural perspective you would have from someone, you know, in Toronto or anywhere, for that matter, outside of Southern California. But really, I mean, I think it's we can all agree that Southern California, specifically Los Angeles and Orange County and San Diego, these are epic centers for you know, radical moving forward culture. Musically and spiritually, whatever, you know. And, you know, really, we're like, we were fringe. We weren't part of that, really. We were close but no cigar kind of thing. We lived in the middle of nowhere, and we were just far enough away from these places where, you know, we weren't surfers. We all had surfing posters on our wall because we wanted to be surfers. But, you know, we live in the middle of the desert.
Right.
So we skateboarded, of course, and took that very serious. But so we were different. You know, we were Southern California, but we were desert. And so we were different from, like, L.A. and San Diego. And to be quite honest, and I think I do speak for all the desert people that I grew up with, we were kind of bummed, to be quite honest. I mean, the irony of people showing interest in the desert now is just amazing, because growing up out there, we were bored and we were just, you know, frustrated. And it was, you know, and if that wasn't enough, living in a wasteland, it's hot, you know? So like during the summer, like you don't even skateboard during the day. It's too hot to skateboard. We had to skateboard at night, you know? And, but what it did is, like any people that would grow up in the middle of nowhere, when something comes into town, it's important. And when someone gives you, you know, a cassette tape with, like, you know, hardcore punk, like, that's gold, you know. We didn't have, like, record stores. We didn't have, you know, cool places to play. We didn't have a cool, you know, we didn't have those things that was, you know, readily available everywhere in San Diego and in LA and places like this. So it was like, things were important. We took things to heart, and obviously that being music. So all the people that I grew up with, we loved our music, and it was really important to us. And for those for those of us who were playing music, it was even more important. It was what we lived for. It's all we had. I've kind of, you know, in my own opinion in mind, it kind of reminds me of what it must have been like for the guys who grew up in Jamaica, and how they're isolated. They're on an island, and they're into music, and it's a very serious place. They took their music very serious. That's all they really had, and that was like, that was what brought a lot of people together there. And that's how it was in the desert. It was the same thing for us.
But aside from the music, there's also this, and I liken it to a track off the Brant Bjork and the Bros double album, Saved by Magic. Mm. You do a spoken word track where you talk about a girl, and you talk about, I can't remember the details of it, but I do remember, like, there's a kiss and candy and all this stuff. And the way you lay it out, you got to understand that I went back to when I was 12 years old, and I had to shovel the driveway of my parents' house. And just knowing, like, there was this place, you know, getting into music allowed you to find out about other places. So I knew of all these bands coming from California. That was a real hot spot for all the music I liked. And I just knew that they never had to wear long johns and shovel the driveway. So when I hear a track that you put on Saved by Magic like that, that's my knee-jerk reaction. I go straight to that point in my life when I'm shoveling the driveway of my parents' house. And I remember this one time that I was, like, I was so into Van Halen. And Roth had just put out Crazy from the Heat. And he had all these videos with all these girls in bikinis. And I was shoveling the driveway with long johns on because it was, like, minus 20. And I was like, what the heck? Who lives here when there's, like, Disneyland over there? And so I guess it's always, the grass is always greener. And over the years, you know, with, like, you know, when you grow up, like, the whole, the Roth and the bikinis and the thing, you get a kind of a, more grown up version of that. And I responded in an equal way when I got older to, like, the image I had of the desert and all the music and all the people that I'd see who were coming out of it, all the bands and everything that was coming out of it was something that I, like, really felt a kind of a synergy with, like, an alignment with, although I was, like, on the other side of the continent.
Well, I for me, it was the same. I mean, I grew up and idolizing the Ramones. They were my favorite band, and I romanticized New York. And, you know, and I wanted to, you know, I'm wearing shorts and Vans, and I have an afro, but I want straight long black hair, and I want to wear a leather jacket, and I want to be hanging around at CBGB's, you know. So I was like, I just was about as far as I could be from the environment that spawned my favorite band. So I too had that romantic attachment, and also that frustration of being like, man, I'm in the middle of nowhere with fucking palm trees and like, you know, this sucks, you know. So it's so funny how that happens. But
you just don't realize that you, as an outsider, when you feel like an outsider, it's a real kind of fertile ground for coming up with some cool shit. You just don't realize it when it's happening, which is the way it's supposed to be.
Yeah. You know? And for us, that was certainly how it was, because we had records. And you know, the extent of it was the record covers and what came out the speakers, but we didn't have anything to bounce our ideas off except just ourselves in this small town. And so we were kind of like all leaders, because there was nothing to follow. And I think that's why there's so many, you know, really rich individuals that came out of the desert, you know. And so unique, and we're all have our own style, really, and that's the beauty in us being isolated. And around the late '80s, when I personally started to come into awareness that maybe this hellhole of a world we live in could potentially be something we could be proud of, actually. And that was the revolution, the revolutionary feeling that I had, you know, like, wow, like, you know. So it was interesting, you know.
I remember when we were on tour together, it turned into this thing where at the end of the night, when the cold crowds had already dispersed and it was just the two bands in the dressing room, I don't know how it got to this point, but there's a lot of nights where it would just be our two bands in the dressing room, and then you'd tell these stories about, like, whether it was touring in Caius for the first time, those first tours going across the country. And I remember that one story you told about your first time at CBGB's, and then going inside the club, and then you seeing Joey Ramone.
Joey Ramone, yeah.
And how was that, those first tours, taking it, being so isolated in the desert, and then going out just across the country? How was it, like, and compared to today, when you're kind of doing the same thing as that first tour, but it's on a much more global scale? I mean, is there some sort of similarity, or is it too detached now, or is it?
Well, my experience traveling and touring today, of course, is 100% different than it was in those first tours I did in the early '90s, and back then it was, it was really surreal, and it was kind of a almost like the myth was shattered in terms of, you know, when you're a fan and you have these rock and roll ideologies and dreams and stuff, and then you go out and you travel the country and you realize how much of rock and roll is a fantasy and how appropriately it is. I mean, that's what it is. The blues are a part of rock and roll, and there's a real element to that, but the other part of it is entertainment. You know, it's about blue suede shoes and dancing and having a good time, you know. And then you get out there in a van and you're like, you know, you're making these long drives and you're rolling into town and playing with these bands, and you realize, man, wow, this is like, we're all like a bunch of suckers. You know what yeah. I mean? But it's important. And you love it, and it's what we, you know, for me, I mean, music's my life. And I realized out there on those first tours, like, wow, man, like, this is hard work, man. This is intense. You got to really, truly love this. And thank God I do. And, but it, that's where you really start to reflect on who you are as a musician and why you're into it and, you know, where you come from and what you could potentially contribute to the world of music, specifically rock music. And, so it was a rite of passage for me, you know, in my dream of being a musician and going, gosh, I think your first couple tours are the ones that you decide, wow, do I really want to do this? You know,
yeah.
Could I really do this? And so that was the educational element to those first tours, but it also made me really have a new appreciation for the bands and the music that I grew up with out in the desert. You know, I was like, I thought I was going to be like running into these amazing bands in all these amazing cities. And you know, sometimes you do and a lot of times you don't. And so when I got home, it was like, I was pretty stoked to return to the desert and just kind of get back to the root of things. And then, that was probably the foundation for my contribution to making the music that I make. Yeah.
Yeah. Like when people, come to me sometimes asking for advice about like, how do you get into music? I always tell them, don't do it. Quit. Don't even bother. And it's all, I kind of meet at 75% of it, and the 25% I keep open, because if they hear that and they still continue to knock on the door, well, then maybe they got what it takes. You
sure.
know what I mean? So
yeah.
I think those early tours really are act as like the weeding process. Mm-hmm. And it's only like this, I guess, I don't know if it's the strong survive or the foolish are left. So, but
yeah,
you know,
yeah.
Like you said, you feel like a sucker when you're in the middle of it going, this is it, man.
Yeah.
Where's like the Steven Tyler, like line of coke and women and all that stuff. So yeah,
sure.
Yeah, totally. I've totally felt like I got suckered by like Circus magazine. You know, I'm like, fuck, Jesus, I was only 11 and I'm in my 20s now. You know, like when you first start, I'm like, I'm in my 20s. I'm following an 11-year-old,
mm-hmm.
you know, like who want an 11-year-old's wish.
Yeah. That's how I refer to it. For me, it's 13. I always say, it's the 13-year-old in me.
Yeah.
It's like, that's what's going on.
Yeah.
For sure, man. But that's a beautiful thing, you know. I mean, I say sucker, and I like you said, I'm half serious and half kidding. But it is a beautiful thing. I'm blessed to have a life in music. I did decide to dedicate my life to it, and I'm glad I did. And it's in me, and I feel proud, and I feel confident in being my ability to contribute to rock music. And so it's been a great life with music. I'm stoked about it.
That's the best way to end, man. Thanks, dude.
Well, I spent some time wandering around this town, walking off those vibes that pick me up and then they drop me down. And the local angel spreads her wings when she sees that I fell and broke my crown. She says, where you going? Where you been? I said, I'm broke as a joke and I think I'm going crazy. She said, well, I got all night, and I said, well, then I'll tell you where I've been.